Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 25th of August, episode 2. Really aiming to get up to an hour. So here's various articles. In brief, they don't have authors associated with it. Doubts over organ donation shake-up. An impending opt-out system for organ donations, that is, you have to actually say you don't want to donate organs, may fail to boost transplant rates and could even lead to a fall. From 2020, people in England will be presumed to consent to donation unless they have signed a register to object. The country currently has an opt-in approach where people sign up to give consent. Under both systems, families can veto donations. To gauge the effect of the opt-out system, Megla Osman of Queen's Mary University of London and colleagues asked nearly 1,300 people to imagine they were a family member being asked to make this decision under different rules. They found people felt more certain their relative wanted to donate if they had signed up under the opt-in system than if they had been presumed to consent under opt-out. Inflicted plankton, this is another article, inflicted plankton could make it cloudier. When clouds cast a shadow over a day out, tiny sea creatures may be partly to blame. Oh, a day out. You know, you go out. Okay. The phytoplankton, Emiliana huxleyi, is a single cell encased in calcite discs. When infected with a virus known as EHV, which sheds its exoskeleton, sea spray can fling the discs into the air as an aerosol, and the water vapor can condense around them to form cloud droplets. Miri Transik of Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel and her team tested the effect of the virus on calcite aerosol release. They found it was 10 times higher for infected EHUX. The discs may contribute more to cloud formation than sea salt because their shapes keep them aloft longer. Well, that's rather nice to think that the discs are a great aerosol. Mean robots can help you solve tricky tasks. Cruel robot overlords get more out of their human subjects than nice ones. The mere presence of an unkind robot seems to improve some cognitive abilities more so than being watched by a friendly robot or none at all. The effect of a robot observer on human performance was tested using the Stroop task, in which words printed in different colours appear on the screen and volunteers must identify the colour, ignoring the word itself. People are usually worse at this when the colour and the word clash, like when the word blue is printed in green letters. Nix Valtotta, University of Clermont-Avranches in France, and his colleagues paired volunteers with small, obviously they use rouge and vert, small humanoid robots they could call to. The robots were programmed to either answer all questions negatively or all positively, which led them to being seen as mean or friendly. Gosh, this is bizarre research. Those who had mean robots were faster at the task and made fewer mistakes than those who had friendly ones or no robots. It seems the systems gave more attention to the bad robots that made them focus on the colour of the word, not on reading it. With cruel robots makes us better at the Stroop task. They probably won't work in every situation. That really goes into it. I'm just thinking overall bad managers have a positive effect because they shake things up. You're less focused on the task at hand. I think more that disproves it. You have to really buckle down and focus at the task at hand. With, I suppose, bullying and things like that. Honey, I Ate the Kids Again. Raising kids hard, even for fish male blinis sometimes eat their eggs if they think they aren't worth the effort and want a better batch. After female barred chin bellinis lay eggs, they leave their male partners as the sole in charge, caring for them until they hatch. This arrangement usually works well, but if the female leaves less than 1,000 or so eggs, the male typically eats them instead of looking after them. It's thought this was because the nutritional value of eating eggs outweighed the benefits of protecting only a few offsprings. But Yuko Matsuoka of Nagasaki University in Japan and his colleagues found that the motivation was actually to enable them to breed again as soon as possible and to get even larger, healthier batch of young. They showed that the breeding cycle of the male R. niches found in Asia is tightly controlled by the presence and absence of eggs. When eggs are laid in the nest, the testosterone levels of the male fish drop and they cannot mate, perhaps to make them stick around parenting. When the eggs hatch about a week later, the testosterone levels rise and they can court females again. Low-carb, high-meat diets could cut years off life. Wouldn't be off life? Okay, double F. And there's no... it's from The Lancet. Diets in low carbohydrates have been linked to reduced longevity unless they are dominated by plant-based foods. Analysis of the data of 15,400 people in the US found that those who live the longest tend to get 50-55% of their energy from hydrocarbohydrates. At the age of 50, such people could expect to live a further 33 years. This is 1 year longer than those who obtain 70% of their energy from carbs. Okay. If you get less than 30% of their calories from this food groups. So let's try and work this one out. This is 1 year longer than people who get 70% of their energy from carbs, and 4 years longer than people who get less than 30% of their calories from this group. Sarah Sullivan of Birmingham's Women's Hospital in Boston and her colleagues wondered if the types of fat and proteins people eat in low-carb diets might contribute to reduced longevity. Diving into the data, they found that when people replace carbs with meat, such as lamb, pork and beef and chicken, typically for low-carb dieters in Europe and US, their mortality rose. But the opposite is true for those who ate plant-based sources of fat and protein, such as nuts, legumes and vegetables. This seems to link with a high mortality rate of low-carbs, high-meat diets is due to lower intake of vegetables and fruit, as well as, hello... are you visiting? So continuing this article. Sorry for that interruption. The team thinks the higher mortality of low carb, high meat diets is due to the lower intake of vegetables and fruits, as well as the harmful effects of animal proteins and fats on the body systems that counter inflammation and oxidative stress when cells are threatened by a surge of reactive molecules. So eating, it's basically eating meat is bad. For those who eat lots of carbohydrate, death rates may be higher due to the metabolic problems associated with large quantities of refined carbs. So this is a complicated thing. Eating vegetables is good for you. So I'll just try and do that. A 4D printer creates complex ceramics. Pottery has a futuristic makeover. It's now possible to 4D print ceramics, which are, I suppose, three-dimensional shape and colour, which could be used for strong, complex parts in rockets and electronic devices. It's interesting that the Electra space rocket, launched from New Zealand, is got 3D printed rocket parts and a electric rocket engine. I don't know how well that's going to go. 4D printing involves making structures that change shape in response to stimuli such as heat, light and elastic forces. This is useful for creating complex objects which are mostly being limited to flexible materials like metals and plastics. Now, Xin Liu of City University of Hong Kong and his colleagues have used ceramics which have the advantage of being extremely strong and able to cope with extreme temperatures. Researchers developed a ceramic ink by mixing ceramic nanoparticles and silicon rubber, which they used to print stretchy sheets. To create 4D structures, the researchers stretched the sheets and attached the joints to various patterns. Once released, the elastic forces and patterns of the joints made the sheets contract and change to bend in helical shapes. Finally, heating to 1,000 degrees caused them to react with the air and form rigid, hard ceramics. I don't know how exactly that's 4D. To snap spaghetti in two, add a twist. It is a puzzle that has perplexed physicists for decades. Holding a strand of dry spaghetti at both ends, bend it until it snaps, and you'll always end up with two or more pieces. In 2005, researchers in France finally discovered why. After an initial break, the brittle spaghetti flexes back in the opposite direction, snapping itself again. Yet, the lingering question of how to overcome this culinary conundrum. Was it possible, with the right technique, to snap a strand of spaghetti just in two? Mathematician Sean Dunkel of the people knew that before 2004, because you can actually see the actual stress fracture in spaghetti. If you look at the shards and reconstruct it, you can see that has happened. There's a fracture pattern, which is not directly clear for across. There's a thing from the direction, you can see where it's come. Okay, has concluded you can, provided you twist in the mix using a pair of clamps, they twist the strands of spaghetti almost 360 degrees before bringing two clamps together until the strands broke. With this method, they could reliably get the spaghetti in two. Using high-speed camera, they found the twist prevented the two remnants flexing back quite as forcefully as the untwisted strand. The untwisting motion also released some stored energy, further reducing the likelihood of a second fracture. So it's really interesting. it is interesting looking at the stress fracture and optical fibres of going in and seeing of twists and the various patterns, stress and optical fibre. The UK life expectancy is starting to ease off with no one knows why. Claire Wilson and Andy Coughlin explore the possibilities. The big slowdown. The past century saw a rapid growth in life expectancy, a key measure of progress, but no longer. UK figures released this month show that life expectancy of people in the country currently at 79 for men, 83 for women, has started to rise more slowly. The change isn't something to panic about. It's life expectancy isn't falling. It's not rising as fast as it was. But it will have an impact. Potentially, it's a big societal cultural change that we are seeing, says Nick Strife, UK's Office for National Statistics, ARMS, which produced the figures. Life expectancy is calculated from the proportion of deaths in people at each age. The death rates have been falling in all Western countries for decades, thanks to rapid improvements in medicine and nutrition. Fall started to slow down at 2011 in the UK. It first could have been a statistical fluke, but the latest mortality figures are now classed as a real change. They mean that although life expectancy was previously climbing about 3 months a year for women and 4 months a year for men, it's now 2 weeks and 1 month a year for both respectively. Similar trends have been seen in other countries, in the US, Australia, Germany, the ONS reported. However, that doesn't mean the lower growth of life expectancy will become the norm. In other countries such as Japan, Denmark and Italy have previously seen a slowdown in life expectancy increases but then reverted to the old higher rate. The trend could reassert itself, says Threat. We do not have enough data to say. What happens next will have tremendous importance on the future of the UK. So what are the possible explanations to slow down? Sick at heart. For a long time, we have been successfully reducing death rates from heart disease and strokes, but the knock-on effects are a major factor behind the unexpected black sling in life expectancy, says the ONS. What does ONS stand for? I don't know. Oh, Office of National Statistics. Death rates for these conditions plunged 70% in the past 3 decades, thanks to parts heart surgery, anti-smoking campaigns, and introduction of drugs for low blood pressure, also both prevent heart attacks and stroke. Now, many of those who benefited are starting to die. One factor could be that the hearts who of those saved by surgery eventually give out through heart failure, for there is no effective treatment, shifts to unhealthier habits could be another. Although smokers in the UK continue to quit, the biggest help to avoid heart trouble, gains are potentially being lost through poor diet and lack of exercise, says Rory Collins of the University of Oxford. Deadly dementia. More than two-thirds of deaths in the UK in people are over 75, so most of the recent slowdown in life expectancy improvements is likely to stem from changes to the death rates in these age groups. The obvious factors for the increasing numbers of deaths is due to dementia. Some of this is down to doctors being willing to put dementia as a cause of death, and because increased awareness and reduced stigma. But there's also a real rise in this condition. The more people survive heart attacks and cancer, the less likely to get Alzheimer's disease and other kinds of dementia. In turn, can cause pneumonia. People with dementia have a difficulty swallowing, which leads to food entering the airways, triggering infections. Rise in dementia causes is likely to persist because, unlike heart disease and cancer, we have no effective therapies for it. Quote, the numbers will continue to rise in the absence of new treatments, says Matthew Norton at the Alzheimer's Research UK. Austerity by its stalling life expectancy isn't just an issue for older people. Since 2012, the death rates among aged 15 to 55 has been increasing, mostly through accidents, assaults or suicide. Although the number of deaths in this age group is too small to have much impact on health headline life expectancy figures, the trend could be a sign of something larger. One worry is the cuts in social support and health care resulting from the UK's austerity drive allied to poor prospects could lead to, quote, deaths of despair, like those seen in white middle-aged Americans. There are parallels with the US strike, but thinks the jury's out on whether austerity is to blame for the slowdown in the UK's life expectancy. Quote, all we can say is the data corresponds to an interesting period politically and economically, but correlation is no causation, he says. Also, no doubt is the US economy is stagnating. In 2017, the economic growth was the fifth lowest in Europe, with just 1.7%. Haha, UK. We know that the economic collapse elsewhere has shortened lives. The most well-known occurred following the fall of the Soviet Union, which saw the life expectancy of men plunge from 63.8 to 57.7 between 1990 and 1994. Deteriorating health among working-age men is a type of canary in the coal mine for something deeply wrong with our labour markets, says David Stucker of the University of Broccolini in Milan, Italy. Golden oldies. While the slowdown in life expectancy rise is recent, some factors responsible may have happened decades ago. One could be the dwindling of the so-called golden cohort, a group of people who were born in the decade that followed 1925. For unclear reasons, they have long been experiencing higher rates of improvement in life expectancy than those before born and after. There are several beneficial changes in the 1920s that could have helped kick this off, such as improved nutrition, better sanitation, the advent of vaccines for dysphagia and tetanus. But it still doesn't explain why the rise in life expectancy slowed for those born later. One theory is the golden cohort benefited from eating more fruit and vegetables in their childhood and adolescence because food rationing, which began in the Second World War, was phased out in the 50s, restricted access to unhealthy food. Whatever reason, this group are now in their 80s and 90s, and their numbers are falling, so make less of a contribution to the overall death rates. The health advantages of the groups are beginning to fade from the overall figures, says Stripe. Heroin hike. Another possible reason to slow down life expectancy in the under 55s could be the escalating high drug deaths. National Health Service reports published February reveal that 2,593 people died from drug misuse in England and Wales, 58% more than 10 years earlier, the highest tolls since records began in 1993. Deaths from drug misuse are now the third most common killer from 15 to 49-year-olds, it said. Increasing the availability of purity of heroin has been blamed, doubling the heroin-related deaths between 2012 and 2016, with many of those dying aged 40 or above, according to the report released by Public Health England in September. Quote, people who became addicted to heroin in their teenage years in the 20s, back in the 80s and 90s, are now older, less resilient, and therefore susceptible to overdosing, says Jonathan Watkins of the Pillar Research Network, a think tank in Cambridge, UK, that analyses public health issues. Austerity-related cutbacks in support systems for drug users may also have contributed, he says. Obesity time bombs. Those have long been predicting that today's children will be some of the first in history to have shorter lives than their parents thanks to the obesity epidemics. But it may be premature to assume it's behind the recent slowdown of rate to increase of our life expectancy. Most of the leveling off stems from changes to death rates in people who are in the 70s and older, where there hasn't been so much of a rise in obesity in the UK. Changes in death rates in younger age groups are mainly due to other causes. In fact, it's fairly severe obesity to have much an effect on the lifespan, and the impact declines as people get older. For instance, people in their 60s and 70s who are classed as obese lose just 1 extra year of life on average. Quote, being mildly overweight doesn't cause a huge difference in mortality figures, says Stephen Grove of McGill University in Montreal, Canada. But David Lubin of Harvard Medical School predicts that obesity will have more effect on life expectancy over the next couple of decades. Quote, the impacts are still following through the pipeline, he says. Lives in the Balance by Ian Angus. Making population control as part of the fight against climate change would be very wrong, this author says. A comment. We should we confront population growth as part of the efforts to tackle climate change? The question is raised in the US environmentalists this week. They argue population control ought to be seen as a potential quality policy, quote, policy lever. To their credit, they advocate only voluntary fertility-reducing measures such as education and access to family planning. Unfortunately, history shows good intentions aren't enough to prevent abuses, that voluntary programs frequently turn into the opposite. Either not a program or not voluntary. In Bangladesh, hailed by population lobbyists, success story for voluntary birth control programs, poor women were paid to accept sterilization and a large number accepted the sword when the unemployment was high. In Peru, 350,000 chiefly Quechan and Amerind indigenous minority women were sterilized against their will in the 1990s. Gosh. Must admit, I didn't know that. Such a abomination would result from treating fertility control not as a human right but as a mean to an end. When birth control policies are motivated by demographic, economic and environmental goals, the focus easily shifts away from supporting women's right to choose to pressuring them to make the right choice. This is especially true in nations divided along ethnic, class and racial lines in which those people power sees others as disposable. These kinds of societies are more likely to use population control in the name of climate change. In the past, we were told that reducing birth rates in developing countries would end in hunger and poverty. It didn't. Now we're told it will solve climate change, not because poorer people are higher carbon emitters. They aren't, not because emissions for poor countries might rise. Never mind the nations with high birth rates have lower per capita emissions than economic development in those places is controlled by corporate entities, not populations. Never mind that most industries in poorer nations produce goods for wealthier ones, that poorer people have no influence over which technology firms use, get little benefit from polluting industries, and the main victims of global warming. And I love this. It's beautiful. Article. The science, as the science author says, safe, affordable contraception should be available for all, so we can choose whether and when to bear children. But linking birth control to climate change risks eroding women's right to choose. If each country treats women's rights instrumentally as a means to achieve environmental ends, they will strengthen repressive entities and deter poorest women from backing environmental causes. Climate policies must incorporate the deepest respect of human rights and social justice. Population control does not qualify. And Ian Angus, edits online journal Climate and Capitalism, co-authored Too Many People, Population, Immigration and Environmental Crisis. Maximum impact. The Mega Science Journal for Africa will be a big boost to research there, says Curtis Abrams. The wait is nearly over for Africa science. Soon they won't have to rely on collaboration with Western academics and institutions to get work published in a high-profile journal. The first edition of Scientific African, the continent's new mega journal, backed by major publishers, is due in September. It would be a game changer. Lack of access to prominent Western journal represents a catch-22 for many African scientists. Without it, their work can suffer from become less publishable. A generation ago, sub-Saharan Africa share of the world science paper was 1%. By 1996, it had dropped to 0.7%, where it stayed almost a decade with no sign of recovery, according to Robert Chisholm of Leiden University in the Netherlands. Scientific African will give a welcome added incentive for research into regional challenges which might not be prominent on the Western agenda. Malnutrition, conflict, adaptation to climate change, unproductive agriculture, and hemorrhagic disease, which Ebola, I suppose. The new journal, of course, will publish on broader topics. South Africa is co-host of The Square Kilometre Away, which is Australia, an effort to build the world's largest radio telescope. Robotics engineer Ashley Olinto of the Ghana-born NASA scientist who worked on the robotic craft and found water on Mars has established the Ghana Robotics Academy Foundation. Based about the hopes that it will work that has remained in the shadows will get exposure, aiding African research careers. This could rebalance partnerships. As it stands, collaboration is pretty much skewed towards Western nations who have largely conceptualized and designed projects without much, if any, input from African colleagues. That could bring us closer to the ideal and local solutions to local challenges, as championed by William Easley, an economist at New York University. He sees this as a more effective way for poorer nations to achieve prosperity than grand schemes of the West that, by and large, have failed to deliver social economic benefits. Change won't come overnight, but Scientific African debut will be an important moment, once one with an outsized impact. Glyphosate ruling and odds with evidence. I have to actually look. This is glyphosate, your famous Roundup. Okay. Tom Cheevers is the author. Does weed killer cause cancer? According to a ruling in California court last week, yes. Monsanto, the agricultural chemical company, was ordered to pay $250 million more to Dwayne Johnson Pitcher, a groundkeeper who says his terminal cancer was caused by their products Roundup and Ranger Pro, which contain the chemical glyphosate. The ruling led to Greenpeace calling for the sales of the weed killer to be and the shares of Monsanto parent company Bayer to drop. Meanwhile, Therese Coffey, an environmental minister of the UK government, is under fire for her tacit support of products, having tweeted that she was about to deploy the amazing Roundup. But while the jury ruled that Johnson's cancer and non-Hodgkin lymphoma was probably caused by glyphosate, the evidence for the link is extremely thin. Quote, I don't think there's any good scientific evidence, said Paul Farrow, who studies cancer epidemiology at the University of Cambridge. We simply don't know if glyphosate was a relevant cause of cancer in this case or any other, he says. In 2015, the International Agency on Research on Cancer, IARC, a branch of the World Health Organization, said that glyphosate was probably carcinogenic, having reviewed the evidence. But Farrow says this decision is controversial. The IARC found no evidence at all from human studies. Its evidence from animal studies is unconvincing sometimes. Some of the studies in rats and mice found evidence of raised risk of certain tumours at very high doses, while other studies found no association. In particular, there was no evidence of the raised risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But Johnson's little, it's bizarre, said Farrow. You can't tell a coherent story. Narek's finding stands out further because separate views of glyphosate safety under the European Food Safety Authority and the European Chemicals Agency and the US Environmental Protection Agency found no increase in risk of cancer. Another review by a different branch of the WHO also found that glyphosate isn't carcinogenic in rats, although it could rule out that it might be in mice in very high doses. Cancer Research UK says there is a quite small amount of evidence that people exposed to very high doses might have increased risk, but no evidence of a risk at normal levels. There's also a problem that there is no plausible mechanism for cancer, usually a result of DNA damage, which glyphosate doesn't cause. It doesn't cause DNA damage directly. Farah adds that the jury's wariness was understandable. Major corporations have long and inglorious history of obfuscating evidence that would make their products seem harmful. The manufactured doubt over the links between tobacco and cancer, fossil fuels and global warming are obvious examples. But there's no evidence that this has happened here. There have been several independent studies finding no link. It is okay to be cautious about big companies selling chemicals and claiming they are harmless, but in this specific case, glyphosate, the likelihood of causing cancer is somewhere between zero and negligible. This is a very short article describing a rather spectacular photograph. I'm doing well, 30 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes into reading this. Helping Hand. This is Indri, the largest of Madagascar's endemic lemurs, and it really does need all the help it can get. Almost all the members of this iconic group of primates, which range from mouse-sized animals up to Indri, which is as big as a small child, are on the brink of extinction. This month, an assessment of the International Union for Conservation of Nature said that 95% of lemur species are at risk, making this the most threatened mammal group anywhere on the planet. This Indri, I-N-D-R-I, is known for its stunningly loud call. Like other lemurs, it's a victim of hunting, habitat loss to slash and burn agriculture. Its larger size, it weighs 9 kilograms, makes it a prime target for hunters and means its bigger territory requires a bigger territory to survive. Conserving it will be a challenge because it has never bred in captivity. Preserving it in its wild habitat, its best hope. Well-managed, protected areas offer the greatest chance of success. And ecotourism provides a vital income as impoverished nations. Christoph Schweitzer, a lemur expert at Bristol Zoological Society in the UK, says there's still time to save these animals. Quote, I'm an unfaltering optimist and remain hopeful that the 107 lemur species will survive the current extinction crisis in Madagascar, he says. We haven't yet lost a single lemur species in modern times, and even though the rarest one, the northern spotted lemur, is down to just 60 individuals in the wild, these populations can bounce back to larger numbers if conditions are right for them. This is an interview. Genesis George Church tells Catherine DeLarange why we should get our genome sequence and why sperm editing mustn't be sidelined and how dogs will lead us to age reversal. He made his name as a pioneer in gene sequences in the 90s. Since then, however, George Church has also gained a reputation for something of a maverick, which is often controversial ideas on how to apply gene editing, most notably his project to bring back the woolly mammoth. Church is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and a prolific entrepreneur. He also worked for decades to get more people to have their genome sequenced, and with his latest company, he hopes he has a hit on the way to just do that. Question. Why have you set up Nebula Genomics? Answer. It's not the first time I've tried to figure out a way to get affordable genomes to people on Earth. I've tried many models. I think this one is the best as it addresses several issues. One of those is trust, because we're using secured encryption. The other is price. I used to think it would take some magic price that would trigger everyone to get their genome sequence. Now I've concluded that even zero is not good enough. We're going to have to pay people to have it done. Question. Why do you think people are resistant to getting the genome sequence? One reason is poor communication of its value by the press and even my colleagues. As a result, most people imagine that they are not at risk of having a child with genetic disease if no one in their family has ever had one. This is far from the facts. Most infants are born severely affected the first time in their family history, as far as the parents know. It's like seatbelts. For years, people wouldn't install seatbelts, and once they're installed, they wouldn't buckle them, even though it's clearly good for them and it does no harm. The same is true of getting a genome sequence. It would help you prevent a proportion of tragic birth defects. It's all across upwards of $1 million each. And you can save the healthcare system's trillions of dollars. Question. So you think everyone should get their genome sequence? I don't think everyone should do any particular thing other than breathe and eat, and probably, yes, it's good for public health. 95% of people will find there's no point in sequencing their genome, but they don't know in advance. Imagine you're coming to the end of your life and sitting in a hospital and you say to yourself, why did I bother getting seatbelts and airbags? That would be a very weird way to think about seatbelts, but it's not a weird way to think about genetics, apparently. Question. You are also working on gene editing in sperm. Why is this important? Answer. If you have a couple who are both unaffected and carriers of genetic condition, they have a high chance their children are being affected very seriously. An alternative to standard practice right now, which is abortion and IVF, you could edit the sperm and remove the faulty gene. Procreation would then be indistinguishable from the usual, except up to the up front you engineer some of the cells in the testes. And I have been one of the people making sure that this is in the conversation, because gene editing conversation has a tendency to go to embryos rather than sperms. I think there's a huge difference, certainly in how you accept all that to certain groups. For example, in 2004, Vatican Commission imagined a scenario in which editing sperm would be acceptable. It could avoid the unnaturalness of in vitro fertilization and abortion. Question. But any gene editing that results would be passed on to the next generation faces regularly obstacles, right? Answer. The US Congress voted for legislation that prevents the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, from evaluating the safety and efficacy of germline editing. They didn't explicitly ban sperm editing, but it's implicitly banned. I don't think they thought that through. The people who promoted the aspects of the bill were probably anti-abortion, but ironically, the bill is delaying the arrival of technology that would reduce the number of abortions on medical grounds. Question. Do you have another commercial venture brewing? Answer. That's a complicated one. We've just had 13 startups coming out of my lab alone. One of them, Rejuvenate Bio, is working on aging reversal in dogs initially. Question. Why work on the aging of dogs, reversal of dogs first? One of the reasons is that we can make the costs much lower. The FDA approval, veterinary products are a lot faster and cheaper, and I want the world to get used to the idea that genetic therapies can be inexpensive. Dogs are really good product targets, as they are also a good segue for humans, because they are similar in size, live in our environment and eat our food, responsible for their emotional states, and in many ways they are like children. We want to do this in dogs that are at least 11 years old. We've tested age reversal in mice, and they're at least 2 years old, and mice are almost dead with aging. What do you mean by age reversal? Well, there's acute diseases where recovery is faster in young animals. For example, heart problems, in which there is essentially no recovery when you're old, but it's very fast when you're young. So we are looking at things like how gene therapy can aid recovery in cardiac damage, kidney problems, obesity, diabetes, and a lot of things really only kill people, only kill dogs that are 10 years old. Aging reversal is a much better target for longevity. It's very difficult to get FDA approve a drug that will make you live 20 or 30 years longer. The FDA requires you to prove exactly what you want to put on the label. So if you want to put 30 years added to longevity, you have to do a 30-year study. We're saying that we can achieve an aging reversal in maybe a couple of months, so then our study can be short. Do the animals you are treating look the same afterwards? Mice look the same, perhaps a little friskier. cover story, Mind Over Matter, by David Robson. And the byline is, simply changing your attitude could make you fitter, slimmer, less stressed, and even younger, finds David Robson. Quote, our minds aren't passive observers simply observing reality as it is. Our minds actually change reality. The reality we experience tomorrow is partly the product of our mindset we hold today. End quote. That's what Alia Crum, the global movers and shakers of this year's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. It may sound like New Age nonsense, but Crum, who heads the Mind and Body Lab at Stanford University in California, can back her claims up with hard evidence showing the mysterious influence of the mind has over our health and well-being. Crum's pioneering research is inspired by her own experience as a child gymnast and a college ice hockey player. Quote, you can be the same physical being from one day to the next, she says, but your mindsets can have a dramatic effect on your performance and psychological capabilities. She often wondered why. Then, as a psychology student, she read about the placebo effect and had a eureka moment. If our expectations can influence the effectiveness of a drug, perhaps something similar can happen to other situations too. Pursuing the idea, Crum and others have discovered that your mindset affects everything from your weights and fitness to your physical toll of insomnia and stress and even how well you age. The upshot is that two people could have identical genes and lifestyles, but one end up healthier than the other, thanks solely to the difference in thoughts. Placebos are inert pills used in most clinical drug trials. The participants are divided randomly into two groups. Half take the drug being tested. Look, I must admit this is true by just speaking to a class and calming them down before a test and just calming them down. They do dramatically, dramatically better. That's the greatest influence. Your mindset before a test is amazing. With no active ingredient, the placebo shouldn't have any effects, yet it often brings about measurable changes, triggering the release of natural painkillers and lowering blood pressure, for example, all because of people's expectations. Patients sometimes reap these benefits even when they know they are taking placebos. On the downside, our expectations of a pill can also produce side effects, including nausea and skin rashes. These placebo effects are evil twin, the nocebo effect. Yeah, okay. Crum was blown away when she learned how powerful these effects can be. Quote, but what surprised me most is the fact that we've done relatively little to understand and harness and improve the health and well-being. She says, governments spend huge amounts of money encouraging us to adopt healthy lifestyle. But what if our efforts could be boosted or undermined by the various psychological process that influences the drug efficacy through placebo and nocebo effects, Crum wondered. She spent the past decade investigating that possibility. One of Crum's first experiments examined the fitness of 84 hotel cleaners. She suspected a few of them would be aware of the sheer amount of exercises the job entails, and this might prevent them from gaining full benefits of that workout. To manipulate their mindset, she gave half of them a detailed information about the physical demands of their work, such as the fact that hoovering burns 200 calories an hour, and told them that their activity met the Surgeon General's exercise recommendations. 1 month later, despite reporting no change in their diet and activity outside work, the cleaners who received information had lost about a kilogram each. Their average blood pressure had dropped from elevated to normal. The others showed no difference. It was admittedly a small study, and Crum didn't record the actual behaviour. Quote, it could be that they were putting slightly more oomph into making the bed, she says. However, a follow-up study with her colleague Octavia Zart bolstered the idea that people's expectation directly influenced their body's response to exercise. That study used data from health surveys monitoring more than 60,000 people up to age 21. Zart found that the, quote, perceived fitness of participants and how they felt compared to the average person was a better predictor of risk of mortality than the amount of time they spent exercising. Crucial. Oh, God. Hopefully no one died. Oh, risk. I don't know how they did that one, because after 21. Crucially, some wore accelerometers for part of the survey period, yet after taking the actual physical activity into account, the influence of their perceived fitness remained. However, people who took more pessimistic view of their fitness were up to 71% more likely to die during the survey compared with those who thought they were the more active than average, whatever the exercise routine. Even 21%, 60,000, you've only got two or three, well, I don't understand. 71% more likely, that's a, you know, a fraction, 71's a prime number. So that's saying that there must be over 100 participants. How this works is a bit of a mystery. We know that the brain can directly control blood pressure through autonomic nervous system. In addition, Crumb suspects poor perception of your fitness could be triggering inflammation and release of hormones such as cortisol, which might help determine how the body responds. Why not test those tests? You know, well, if you believe, and you can do hormones, you can do a hormone test. Her team is investigating possible mechanisms, she says. It's not too early to take advantage of the effects. Crumb's advice, which she follows herself, of course she would, is not to deceive yourself about your fitness, but to make sure you don't undervalue the exercise you do either. You should also avoid comparing yourself critically with your peers, particularly if they are exceptionally sporty. Fabio Benetti of the University of Turin Medical School, Italy, who has pioneered work on the placebo-nocebo effect, praises the findings. Quote, Crumb's work is very interesting and her approach to health important from both medical and psychological viewpoint, says Benedetti. He stresses the need for caution, given the many variables that influence everyday fitness, but argues that, quote, we can learn a lot about the mechanisms, implications, and applications of the mind-body connection from such studies. Crumb has now documented many other ways in which our mindset could be harming our health. The nocebo effect may undermine the efforts of losing weight and dieting, for instance. In 2011, Crumb offered volunteers a milkshake at her lab that measured their levels of hunger hormone, ghrelin. Okay, I'll have to know that. I want to do a tour of that one, which is drops normally after a meal. Although everyone received the same shake, some were told it was healthy while others were led to believe they were having an indulgent treat. The impact was striking. Those who thought they were drunk a low-calorie shake showed markedly high level of ghrelin afterwards, which left them feeling less full. Ghrelin doesn't affect appetite alone. By signaling the food's deprivation, the hormone also slowed down metabolism, tipping the body towards storing fat rather than burning it. Oh, no, I don't quite understand it. So if you eat in a high-carb diet, if you're told it's healthy, you don't think it's fat, so you don't... Well, I can sort of see that. So, ghrelin. Okay. It makes excellent sense to reduce energy consumption when resources are scarce, but it's bad news when we're trying to lose weight. We think people are eating healthily, and that's associated with a sense of deprivation, says Crumb, and that mindset matters in shaping a physiological response. Psychological response, instead of suggesting dieters should cultivate a mindset of indulgence, savoring the textures and flavours, whatever they're eating. So when you... So actually thinking you're dieting is actually working against it. Non-dieters could be falling prey to this effect too. When we drink sugary beverage, our brain doesn't seem to recognize liquid as a source of energy and fails to adjust the digestion accordingly, so we tend to eat more afterwards than if we eat in solid food containing the same number of calories. However, it is possible to subvert the effect by changing our expectations. Richard Mears at Purdue University in Indiana primed couples to believe that the energy drink was solidified once it reached their stomach, as well as lowering their ghrelin levels. This increased their insulin response after consumption, and the drink stayed in their stomach longer, all of which left them feeling fuller. Quote, that was followed by a decrease in the daily energy they consumed, says Matz. Crumb, who's also investigating the influence of our expectation on stress, it's well known that chronic stress can lead to reduced cognitive performance, high blood pressure, compromised immune systems. But can the fear of stress itself worsen its sample effects? To find out, Crum first assessed students' attitudes by getting them to rate statements such as, quote, experiencing stress depletes my health and vitality, and, quote, experiencing stress enhances my performance and activity. She then told them that they had to give a short presentation and face the prospect. Those who considered stress as debilitating rather than enhancing showed the largest psychological reactions, including greater fluctuations in the level of stress hormone cortisol. So she's actually measuring it now. Such reactions are thought to underpin the most, so it's another thing, cortisol, and that's ghrelin. Such reactions are thought to underpin the most damaging health effects of stress. However, moderate stress can actually improve health, triggering the production of hormones necessary for cell growth, among other things. Quote, there's a lot of public health messages that warns us about the effects of stress, but it's one-sided and builds the mindset that stress is debilitating, when in fact there are many enhancing qualities, says Crum. The more simply understanding stress needn't be damaging to our bodies to cope with it. After watching a video on the ways that stress can boost the focus and creativity, Crum's participants showed more optimal hormone responses under stress, marked by moderate levels of cortisol and raised levels of growth-promoting hormones. Tired all the time? It just smells of really poor science here. I hope the science isn't good. The dangers of stressing about stress might explain some insomnia too. About a quarter of the people's perception of how well they sleep are correlated with the sleep they actually get, which potentially significant repercussions. Quote, complaining good sleepers, people who believe they are insomniacs even though monitoring the nighttime brain activity suggests otherwise, are likely to experience symptoms such as daytime fatigue, high blood pressure, depression, and anxiety. Quote, non-complaining bad sleepers, by contrast, are remarkably free of ill effects. Worry about poor sleep is a stronger pathogen than poor sleep, said Kenneth Lisson of the University of Alabama, who made the discovery. It is possible that constant daytime fatigue leads someone people identify as insomniac rather than insomnia causing fatigue. But at least one study supports the idea that a placebo effect is partly responsible. It found that simply priming participants to think they had slept poorly or unusually deeply influenced their cognitive function the next day. All these findings give us plenty of reasons to reassess our mindset. But perhaps the most provocative research concerning aging concerns aging, with strong evidence that negative beliefs could knock decades off your life. The first clues emerged in the early 1980s. Ellen Lager at Harvard University, who later collaborated with Crum on the hotel cleaner study, took a group of pensioners to a monastery in New Hampshire and told them to act as if they were 22 years younger for the duration of the stay. The retreat was decorated in the year of 1959, and filled with music, films, and magazines and books from the era. The rooms contained no mirrors. Any pictures of their younger selves. After just 5 days, the pensioners' arthritis had improved, their posture was more upright, and their thinking, measured by their IQ test, was sharper. Inspired by the studies, other teams have since shown that attitudes really can influence how our bodies fare over time. Overall, people who view aging positively live 7.5 years longer than those who associate frail and senility. Negative perceptions of aging are not merely a result of poor health. They can foreshadow symptoms by as much as 38 years. Admittedly, people with a pessimistic view of aging are less active and less likely to seek health care when they need it. However, many studies find this cannot fully explain the effect on health. So what's going on? You'd think that that is the button to press. You know, if you could actually do that, it's more important than spending billions of dollars on sports stadiums. It seems people with rosy beliefs about aging react less to stress and are less likely to develop inflammation, both of which means they age more slowly. Rebecca Levy of the Yale School of Public Health has found that they tend to have longer telomeres, protective caps on the end of their chromosomes. Oh, God. This matters because telomeres wear away with time, so the yardstick of age, such people are also less likely to develop brain changes associated with Alzheimer's disease than those who view aging negatively. Ageism is deeply ingrained. We know that children as young as 3 or 4 already assimilated age stereotypes of their culture, says Levy. But a later study suggests that attitudes can be changed. In one, participants aged between 61 and 91 played a computer game, while positive age-related words such as wise, mature, and experienced flashed briefly on the screen. Although they did not consciously register the word, their perceptions of aging had significantly improved after the session had and has their physical well-being. Amazingly, the benefits include an increase in mobility surpassed by 6 months physical exercise regime. No wonder the researchers are calling the campaigns to educate people about the dangers of ageism. Now, having had exercise physiology, your actual attitude can actually affect your stance. So there are certain things like the way you actually hold yourself. Being aware of these stereotypes, questioning them, and developing resistance to them, that's a good skill people can learn at any age, says Levy. Of course, a positive mindset is not a panacea, but these findings could help us all benefit more from our efforts to achieve a healthy lifestyle through exercise, a balanced diet, relaxation, and getting a good night's sleep. Quote, it's about being mindful, oh God, of the fact that we have mindsets that they matter, and being empowered by the possibility that we can choose more useful mindsets, says Crumbs. One of the ironies reading about mindfulness is that the approach for mindfulness, or the actual accepting of mindfulness as a solution, is the most mindless thing I've ever come across. So, 55 minutes. So this is the next article. I've got to go for an hour. Ice Sage, rather than Ice Age. It took a singular Scot, an unschooled James Croll, to explain the Earth's recurrent cold spells, finds Fred Pierce. He was a janitor who unlocked the secret of how ice ages happened. The sickly son of a poor Scottish farmer, James Croll left school at 13, became an itinerant labour and a failed salesman. Sounds like me. But decades of private reading and astonishing capacity for original thought saw him soar to scientific stardom. Croll became the father of climate change research and corresponded as an equal with science heavyweights of the day, including Charles Darwin, Lord Kelvin. I now know Lord Kelvin is named after the Kelvin River in Glasgow. He's a bit of a jerk, as far as I can see. I love all the ideas of Kelvin. It's just... Oh, just so much frustrating academic. Explorer Fridtjof Nansen and geologist Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell had the gradualism that Charles Darwin read in the book. You have probably never heard of him. His star waned. His insights about cosmological causes of great glaciation sank from view until revived half a century later by Serbian mathematician Milton Milankovitch, who took the portus. Croll died in penury, a footnote even on his own gravestone. Was he the victim of Victorian snobbishness, or might he have fared even worse if he lived in the modern age? Croll was born in 1821 and raised on a small holding of moorland in rural East Scotland, land he worked for a young age. His sporadic schooling ended at 13, but he then stumbled across a copy of The Penny Magazine, the New Scientist of its day. He came hooked at science by 14, which is really important. I think these magazines are just not getting out to our kiddies enough. Perhaps podcasting is the way to go. And that is, I really should get young people reading podcasts. By 14, he was reading a great science text of his time. Quote, At first I became bewildered, but soon the beauty and simplicity of the conceptions filled me with delight and astonishment, he later wrote in his autobiographical sketch. I studied pneumatics, hydrostatics, light, heat, electricity, magnetism. I obtained assistance from no one. His head was full of ideas, but Croll had no qualifications and no money. At 16, he was travelling millwright, sleeping in a rat-infested barns. Later he became a joiner before damaging his elbow left him unable to do manual work. He's also, as his step-nephew James Campbell Irons wrote in a, biographical appreciation, quote, heavy and ungainly, as well as modest, shy, dry, and almost speechless manner. Not surprisingly then, Kroll also failed as a tea merchant and insurance salesman and went bankrupt as the landlord of a temperance hotel. So temperance means no drinking in a town of 35,000 people and 16 taverns. So so it's 3,500. There's a small village and it's got 16 taverns. So that's one tavern for every 200 people. By luck, eventually he found himself a neighbour of the head of Anderson's University, a forerunner of Strathclyde University. Kroll became a caretaker, and his duties done, he would hole up in the library pursuing great scientific issues of the day. One of those was the course of the Ice Ages. Geologists had deduced that large parts of Europe had been repeatedly covered by ice, but nobody knew what caused the waxing and waning. There were some theories, well, there's two theories, is going through the arms of the galaxy and also the orbits, the changing shape of our orbits. Let's see what they say. An astronomical phenomenon, but it was Kroll's untutored free-ranging mind that would crack the conundrum. By painstaking calculation, he showed that over more than a million years, the glaciation appeared to coincide with periodic streams of what astronomers called eccentricity, the variation in the elliptical shape of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Has only a tiny effect on the total amount of solar radiation reaching the planet. In his greatest insight, Kroll proposed that it was enough to trigger substantial indirect cooling of the Arctic, in particular by the diversion of the Gulf Stream reducing heat to the pole. As more ice formed, the sunlight was reflected, causing more cooling. As such amplifying feedbacks underpin the estimates of the impact of human-made climate change today. So the actual orbits do change our tilt, doesn't change because we've got the moon to stabilize it, but it does definitely change in Mars. Mars has a more eccentric orbit, and as the eccentricity changes, the actual tilt changes. It's interesting to see how the actual angular momentum stored in the rotation corresponds and goes in between here. So what they're called are maximums. So the time varying feedbacks underpin estimates of climate impact. The impact of human-made climate change today. His ideas were published in 1864, so how old was he? He was 43. In Philosophical Magazine, the top science journal of the day, a paper was attributed to James Kroll, Anderson University. Whether the editor's new Kroll was a janitor is not recorded, but it didn't matter. As Kroll put it, the paper excited a considerable amount of attention. I love that. He was soon corresponding with the greats and goods of science. Darton wrote, quote, I have never, I think, in my life been so deeply interested in any geological discussion, Kroll. Kroll's paper had, he said, cleared so much mist from before my eyes. Then, in 1867, Kroll became secretary of the Scottish Geological Survey in Edinburgh. It allowed him time, despite growing bouts of poor health, to produce a book on his thinking. Published in 1875, Climate and Time appeared to seal his reputation as one of the great era's great scientists. Within months, he had an honorary degree from the University of St. Andrews and a fellowship with the Royal Society in London and the New York Academy of Science. Kroll published more groundbreaking research on how glaciers move, the causes of ocean circulation and the thickness of Antarctic ice, at a time when scarcely anyone had ever set foot on the continent. When he also persuaded Darwin to use that rivers were important agents of erosions. High waters of Kroll's fame retreated at the time, beautiful, at the time he became more reclusive, turning down an invitation to lecture at the British Association, today the British Science Association. He wrote, quote, I dislike all such public displays. There is a cold materialistic atmosphere around scientific men in general that I don't like. I mix but little with them. South Western, he retired in 1880, aged 59. Prime Minister William Gladstone and Lord Salisbury both rebuffed pleas from Darwin, Lord Kelvin and others to give Croll a full civil service pension. He ended up gratuitously rented lodgings in Perth, just streets away from where he bought his first penny magazine. He died a decade later. He was buried in what is now an abandoned churchyard at Cargill. A worn gravestone lists 14 of his forebears, with Croll and his wife Isabella mentioned last. And his smallest letters in space, in the smallest letters, as the space and stone ran out. One obituary called him, quote, among the foremost, if not the first, investigator of physical causes of climate change. But by then, saloons and sites had tired of his testy recluse. Soon his name and theories were largely forgotten. Only in the 1930s were they revised by Milankovitch. So I think they actually named this, who corrected some inaccuracies, in what he calls Croll's remarkable work. Even so, when ocean sediments cause, taken in the 70s, conferred the causal link to juice by Croll, the Scot was so forgotten that the Earth's periodic coolings, oh no, that's right, the Milankovitch cycles. In the past decade, a handful of Scottish academics have tried to rescue Croll's name. There's now a memorial to him outside the Royal Scottish Geographical Society in Perth. Croll's fall is usually painted as a result of Victorian stiffness and untutored working class. Maybe so, but it was a remarkable, says Andrew. Duloxy of the University of East Anglia, UK, is how much respect he did receive in his day, despite his lack of formal qualifications. Leading scientists corresponded with Croll as equal. That would probably be impossible nowadays, given the huge emphasis placed on papers in scientific literature, says Dolgeski. And what journal today would publish a paper, whatever its merit, from a janitor with no formal education? New scientists ask Nature whether its editors could think of such an upstart in the recent Archer's archives. They could not. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.